Hi, and welcome to our Doc Industry Podcast, season number 5. Here's your podcast about creative documentary and animated film industry. It's in collaboration with our dear friends, the Programmers of Color Collective and What's Up with Docs. A big shout out to our partners, supporters, and contributors. Check them out. And hey, it's good to have you here. Enjoy your conversation. Here is Doc Industry Podcast, season number 5.
Hi, everybody. My name is Meena Namji. I'm a filmmaker and educator, born in Kenya of Indian heritage and now living in Los Angeles. I'd like to thank Doc Leipzig, the Programmers of Color Collective, and especially Lucy Mukherjee for inviting me to moderate this conversation, which will be a conversation around ideas of radical and oppositional film, with our three guests today, who I would say are practitioners of this mode. I'm really delighted to have here filmmaker Jean-Marie Tenneau, who's from Cameroon, Pratibha Parma, a filmmaker based in the UK, and Inay Prakash, a film curator based in New York. So I'd love each of you to properly introduce yourselves first and then get into the conversation. So could we start with you, Pratibha?
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Meena, for inviting me to be part of this conversation with Inay and with Jean-Marie. I'm primarily a nonfiction film and video maker. I have worked across many genres and formats, from making experimental videos, as well as documentaries for television for broadcast on BBC and the PBS, to directing episodic drama for American television. And I've also directed a feature drama for limited theatrical distribution, both in the UK and the US. I am based both in London and also in California. And like you, Meena, I was born in Nairobi, Kenya, of Indian origin, but very much Kenyan at heart.
Thank you for that. And Jean-Marie, how about you?
Yes, thank you, Meena, for inviting me. Well, I've been making films. I'm a mostly documentary filmmaker. I've been making films for, let's say, 35, a little bit more. My films take place in Cameroon most of the time. And I came to cinema also following the FESPACO, being there and seeing cinema as being a tool to not only challenge the dominant narratives, but also to speak about things that seems not to be of interest to the vast majority of people. So I've made 13 films so far, among which one narrative film. Most of the films take place in Cameroon or Africa, because I made many films in Cameroon and one film in Burkina Faso. And I made also a documentary from Germany to Cameroon and going towards South Africa, the colonial misunderstanding. So I've been always trying to use cinema as a tool to make the complex world in which we are living more understandable for the majority of people. And now I'm also an educator, because I'm doing workshops in Cameroon and I'm trying to pass over some of my expertise to young filmmakers so that they will not be afraid to address some of the current issues that the African continent is facing right now.
Well, I'd love to get more into that as well. Thank you for that. And Inay, how about you?
Thank you, Meena. As I was saying, it's such an honor to be included in this company. I'm a film curator, as you said, in New York. I have worked with film festivals for most of my career, about 10 years. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. But in 2021, I launched my own film festival called Prismatic Ground, which was initially virtual and now is an in-person festival that maintains an online component. And I focus kind of on three categories of work, ideally overlapping, you know, film by experimental work. You know, I kind of focus on a spectrum of experimental documentary to avant-garde, which can be anything from, you know, any of each of your works. You know, I've shown your work, Meena, and all the way to like a strobing screen for an hour. And then also kind of leftist political agitprop. And the festival just had its fourth year in May at a handful of venues here in New York City.
Okay, great. So yeah, so thank you again to all of you for being here. So yeah, I'd like to foreground, you know, this idea of radical and oppositional film that I think you are all involved in. And what I mean by this is exactly what you said, Jean-Marie, is work that challenges the global dominance of Western aesthetic, political, and economic values, really neoliberal values that are transmitted, I think, by a majority of mainstream films today. And so I wanted to situate your works particularly within this context, as I feel it's not only relevant using the term oppositional, but actually necessary because, so, you know, in the current documentary landscape, while representational issues on the front and behind the camera around race, gender, LGBTQ issues, et cetera, are rightly contested, I do feel that class and this kind of neoliberal ideology that now pervades much of the globe remains largely unexamined. And so I feel this is a big gap where there's a lack of criticality in the discourse. And just to define the term, you know, neoliberalism, I feel that it extends beyond capitalism. It goes beyond economics. It's an ideology that prioritizes the individual over the collective. It imposes free market and competitive principles on all aspects of life, even those not usually considered economic. I think it normalizes whiteness. It valorizes individual wealth over social wealth. So it's this ever-present yet unspoken force. And so I feel until it is named and really, you know, really taken apart and denormalized in the media context, I feel that significant challenges to the status quo on a deeper level can't really be affected until we do this. So I do hope along the way there's going to be much more interrogation of how documentaries and nonfiction also participate in and perpetuate these neoliberal hegemonies. So it's not a new issue, but I do think it's worth revisiting now as we're in this moment in documentary where the rise of large streaming platforms has increased the production and distribution of documentaries. Yet these platforms also narrow the range of acceptable narratives, often favoring spectacle, in quotes, like celebrity culture or true crime, or in demanding Western storytelling tropes like the three-act structure, the hero's journey, etc. Also, the streamers have ever broader reach throughout the world, and therefore the spread of these values has never been greater. And so now, more than ever before, although of course there are truly astonishing and exceptional works that have been made recently, I think all of this really represents a shrinking of cultural diversity, a shrinking of imaginations, and a shrinking of oppositional space. So fortunately, we have cultural producers such as yourselves who have and are still actively resisting this ideology. And so what I'm hoping you'll share really is how you do it. You know, how do you keep your political and aesthetic integrity intact in this kind of hostile environment, I would say, and how do you survive? Okay, so just one more thing before we dive into things is that I just want to say that we are speaking at a time when a monstrous genocide is ongoing in Gaza. So these are not normal times. And as a media maker living in the US, I'm just devastated and appalled by the silence of so many in our industry, including documentary, the festivals, the funders, foundations, who all champion social justice outwardly, and yet have not condemned what's going on. So I just, you know, I think this implicates the complicity of corporate media in underreporting and normalizing this genocide. And this just underlines again how powerful neoliberal media is. which, you know, to me makes the work that you all do even more crucial. Okay, so with that, I do have prepared questions for each of you, but, you know, again, I'd love it to be a conversation. And if you want to jump in or, you know, ask questions of each other or all of that, please, please feel free. If we can start with you, Jean-Marie, and you have said already a bit about your background, but you have been long making films that are radical politically and aesthetically, and you've been deconstructing the colonial and post-colonial long before it became, you know, a thing. Thanks. And so I wanted to talk for you to talk a bit about your early background. You know, how did you first get into filmmaking, and what motivated you to make, you talked a bit about it, but to expand on what motivated you to make films that have this deeply critical edge. So was this conscious, or was it something that you just naturally sort of evolved into?
Yes, it's a very complex and also very simple question. As I haven't been into a film school, for instance, I didn't have a kind of format, a way of doing things. I came to filmmaking just for the fun of doing it, going around with a camera, filming. All these things were really, for me, like really having fun. And at the same time, coming from a background where the question is always, when you are speaking, what are you really going to be talking about? And this was an ongoing question most of the time. So when I wanted to make my first film, the question was, what do I have to say? Do I really have anything to say? Do I really have anything to explore? So all these questions were really important to me. And the question was, cinema has existed for so long. We have all these models. We don't like the models or the way we are being represented. So as an African filmmaker coming to make film, what are you bringing on the table? And this has always been my main question. What, as an African filmmaker, am I bringing in terms of aesthetic, in terms of form? That's how I started making film and asking myself all these questions. And the question of who is speaking and from where am I speaking became also a very important question at the beginning, because I had no model. And even the first person narrative saying I, when I made my first film in 1984, there were not so many models of people doing this kind of first person narrative. And it's only after I made Afrique de Plumeré in 92 that I finally saw Sunless by Chris Marker. And I was so blown away. I said, wow, why haven't I seen this film before? That would have helped me even go deeper into using the first person narrative. So I tried to align my questioning about the world, and also my questioning about cinema. What do I bring to the table in trying to make films? And that was one of the main question I had also when I was making my first film, notably Homage. That was just a conversation between two people that you never see. And at the end, making the twist of having these two people being two faces of the same coin, actually. So these are the kind of playfulness that I try to bring into making film. And I try to follow up with always trying to find original ways of dealing with stories that I wanted to tell.
Yeah, and so Pratibha, I saw you nodding your head at certain points, so maybe the inspiration for filmmaking. But I wonder, you know, you're also, you know, this award-winning, globally recognized filmmaker recognized for your kind of hybrid approach, experimental approach, but also you also represent, you know, one of the first people to sort of represent LGBTQ plus issues of South Asians and Indians. And so I wonder if you could just talk about your early inspirations and what made you want to make films that are oppositional and highly critical of the status quo, I guess.
Yeah, I was nodding because in common with you, Jean-Marie, I never went to film school. So I've never had any kind of formal film training. The way I got into making films and videos was really from a place of political activism. And I was working with young South Asian girls as a community worker. And we did designed with photographs of our own photographs, designed a series of posters. And one of the posters was one of the young girls in a martial arts uniform doing a high kick and with a quote that said, if anyone calls me a PAKI, a Paki, which is a racist slur, I will go kick their heads in. And the poster said, self-defense is no offense. And it kind of got picked up, this poster, and taken, and anti-racist teachers started putting up that particular poster in their schools. And in one particular school, a headmistress saw it and tore it down. And then there was this huge uproar about it, and it ended up as a news item on a mainstream channel, a news program at 9 p.m. And I was like completely gobsmacked. I was like, crikey, what is going on here? You know, and I realized at that point that when you begin to represent your own stories, tell your own narratives in the ways that you want to tell them, how deeply provocative that can be. And that was, you know, and that was such a modest little poster, but it became this provocation without it being meaning to be a provocation. And so that really sort of started me off. And at the same time, I was a postgraduate doing postgraduate studies at Birmingham Cultural and Contemporary Studies Centre, where, you know, Paul Gilroy was, and we were part of the race group, postgraduate race group, and we were working on a book called The Empire Strikes Back, Race and Racism in Britain in the 1970s. So, you know, there was a kind of a confluence of different factors that brought me to wanting to make media which challenged dominant narratives in British media about South Asian people in particular. And that's, you know, and I started off by actually doing, I tried to go to film school, actually. I tried to go to the National Film and Television School, and they needed an example of my work. And I made this video called Emergence, and with the help of the Black Audio Film Collective at the time. And it was about, you know, Black and Third World women as artists. And there was this flourishing of women artists that was happening, was part of the Black Arts Movement here in the UK. And so I made this video. I got an interview at the film school and in the documentary department. And I got into a heated discussion about ethnographic filmmaking, because their most favorite students were this couple who were in, this is quote them, were in Africa, embedded in a tribe somewhere, living with the tribe. And I was like, hello, you know, I think we have to begin to question these kind of paradigms of ethnographic filmmaking. And of course, I didn't get into the film school because, you know, I was going to be a challenge to their very way of making, you know, thinking about documentary film. So, I mean, I could speak a lot more, but it's just sort of, that's kind of what kickstarted. And when I didn't get into film school, I was like, okay, but so what? I'm going to continue to make films. By any means necessary. And, you know, it was the beginning of the advent of the little Hi8 video camera, which I was given, loaned one of those. And I went on to make my second video called Sari Red, which was about a racist murder of a young Asian girl on the streets of London by fascists, white fascists. And I completely did everything on my own with this, you know, Sari Red was like me shooting it, editing it, everything. And it got shown at a tiny little film festival under the arches in Brighton, which is a seaside town, and makeshift little screen. And the next thing I knew, this video got taken up and a Museum of Modern Art bought it, Pompidou Center bought it, and I was called a video artist, up and coming video artist. And I was like, I had no idea what a video artist was. And it was kind of just before Google, I think, so I couldn't even Google it and say, oh, what is a video artist, you know? But that kind of took, you know, set me off really. And that was a few decades ago.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's, you know, it's really interesting because you both were really pioneering this sort of taking nonfiction film in such a different direction. And I think it's really interesting that you did not go, both of you did not go to film school. And I have, I mean, you know, I'd like to talk later a bit about how like documentary training workshops now, you know, what they are actually exporting. But before we get there, I'm just curious, like, you know, in your early works, did you, so you made them on your own, but did that, you know, and pretty big, so you did get institutional recognition, but did that translate, and for both of you, Jean-Marie and did that translate into greater funding, or did you receive pushback, or did, how did it, you know, how did your first work sort of, you know, allow you to be funded more or not, I guess, or by who?
let me continue on the similarities, because when Pratibha talked about ethnographic films, when I arrived in Paris in 1983, I was working for the television and I was saying to everyone, I want to make film, I want to make film. And everybody kept saying to me, oh, you need to go to the Musée de l'Homme and to meet Jean Rouch, who is the father, because everybody was saying, oh, Jean Rouge is the father of African cinema. I said, he's not an African filmmaker. And, but everybody kept saying to me, you should go and meet Jean Rouge and so forth. And I was just there saying, okay. At the end, I finally decided to go to the Musée de l'Homme where he has his office. And I went there a few times and he was never there. So I met this woman who kept seeing me coming. I was a young man, very young at that time. And she, at one point she asked me, young man, you have been coming here, you want to meet Jean Rouch, what do you want? What do you want from this man? And I said, everybody's saying to me, I want to make film. Everybody's saying, oh, you need to meet Jean Rouch. And she looked at me and said, oh, you look very nice, but if you really want to make films, maybe you shouldn't meet him. Go and find your own voice, because none of his students is making any film that is worth. Just go and find your own voice and find your own way. And I said, wow. Why are you saying that? He said, and who are you actually? She said, oh, I've been working with Jean for 20 years. I've been editing all his films and I know him very well. So if you really want to make films that are, go and find your own voice and forget about him. And I left the Musée de l'Homme really completely puzzled. And I went and I made my first short film, Homage. And the first time I met Jean Rouch was at the screening at Cinéma du Réel when he saw the film. That was
great.
He went into cinema. And I was lucky that I didn't meet him before, because if I entered into all the discussions, I would not have dared doing most of the films that I did with the first film that I did on Homage. But I just wanted to put that there are similarities between rejection and not really following the path that everybody wants you to go become creative. Yeah.
That's such a wonderful story. And how did he react?
Oh, but the story continues, because he saw Homage and he stood up and he said, oh, we just received a lesson of cinema. I shot it in 16 millimeter. I shot it my own. I did even the many things. I did it completely like an artisan. And of course, I got the prize of the first short, the best short film at Cinéma du Réel that year. And for me, it was almost like a blessing and also a kind of curse, because every film I did after that, people say, oh, it's good, but it's not as good as homage. So it was a two-way. And I just kept saying, okay, but that's life. And of course, after that, when I did Affliction de Plumeré, I knew that in France, the reaction to that film were not always very sincere. So,
Well, you were asking about sort of the institutional support that I kind of started to get. I think it wasn't necessarily because of the work that I'd been making, but the independent experimental work. It was more that there was a moment when in England, there was a new channel, Channel 4, came on the scene. And they had this absolutely fantastic independent film and video department run by Alan Fountain and Caroline Spry. And they had a vision for it, which was to really encourage and give support to voices that had not been represented on mainstream television. So that meant that they were supportive of women filmmakers, LGBTQ filmmakers, Black filmmakers, filmmakers of color, African filmmakers in some instances too. And so that, you know, I was kind of very lucky that I was around at the sort of inception and the beginnings of that particular moment, which allowed some spaces for some of us to actually enter into those institutions and have dialogue and conversations with them about the kinds of films that we wanted to make. And it just, you know, there was such an openness to our ideas so that when I went in and I said, I want to make a documentary about South Asian LGBTQ people, I want to go to India and I want to kind of capture this particular moment that is happening in these communities, they were like, okay, write us something. So I wrote a one page proposal and they said, okay, great. Here's the money. Go make it. And, you know, that was like, oh my goodness. That was just like the most amazing kind of, I think back now and think how incredible that kind of support was for so many of us. And I think that's when I made a lot of my work in the early 90s, you know, with that kind of support, that then I could make an hour-long documentary on African-American women in the civil rights movement, focusing on Angela Davis and June Jordan and Alice Walker. And it became this film that got shown at 9 p.m. prime time on Channel 4. It sort of, you know, became this water cooler kind of conversation piece because so many women, particularly people of color, had not seen women of color talking on primetime television, telling their own stories in that way. So I think that those sort of few, the early 90s, when, you know, many of us got that kind of support and that break, we were able to sort of say, these are the stories we want to tell. And without very much editorial control, it was just like, either they liked it or they didn't, but they kind of mostly sort of supported many of us. And I think that died, you know. That died in the mid to kind of late 90s, like around 96, 97. So it was a very small window when that was there. But after that, it was pretty impossible. And it has continued to be pretty difficult and impossible to make work that does not fit into the kind of mainstream dominant storytelling tropes and some of the tropes that you kind of outlined in your introduction. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to kind of go on about the challenges of funding, but we all know, all of us know that those, you know, that's there's a real challenge of funding and that kind of institutional support, unless you're making documentaries, unless you're making films with particular tropes around particular kinds of stories.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, just to bring Inay in, it does, you know, highlight the, you know, Inay's your curator, not a funder, but still the issue of curation and being open to and taking the, you know, now radical step of curating work that is, you know, I'll use the term oppositional again, but Ine, you're the younger generation here, and you started, you know, as the founder of Prismatic Ground, you started this in a time, you know, 2021, I think you said, when, you know, avenues are being closed off, when film festivals, larger film festivals, seem to be going through quite a lot of shifting and trouble, really. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about your background. You know, how did you get into this? How were you drawn to a kind of more critical cinema? And then if we could talk a bit about, you know, the idea of Prismatic Ground, if you can explain the title, for instance, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up in suburban Michigan with parents who weren't really in the arts. I loved movies, and so that was my entry into the world of art and ideas. And, you know, I started programming for film festivals while I was in Michigan, but it was when I moved to New York, only in 2019, you know, that my brain cracked open a little bit and I was able to see experimental work on a regular basis. And I think, you know, the lockdown, the pandemic was huge for me because all of a sudden I was watching all this work that I didn't previously know about or have access to. That's when I saw Homage. That's when I saw Place of Rage. That's when I saw your work, Nina, and reached out to you. And how did you
find that work? Like, how did you, just online or?
People, it was this extraordinary moment where everybody was just making their films available online. People were sharing files and you know, because we were all just sitting around and nothing seemed, the old rules didn't seem to matter anymore. So all of a sudden this type of work, which was very hard to access, people started sharing freely. And, you know, I learned about these kind of distributors like Video Data Bank and stuff and started combing through their catalogs. And, you know, I realized that I, you know, what I really have always believed in is film as an art form. And I was like, how extraordinary that there's this stuff that is like the ideal of that. It's like kind of the most extraordinary film art I've ever seen, but it's also got this real political conviction. And, you know, that was huge for me, this idea that there is a marriage of form and content that kind of undermines the neoliberal order of things, and is in that way oppositional. You know, it's not really sellable in a way that makes it, I don't want to say pure, but in a way that points to its potential and to its, you know, subversive qualities. And I, yeah, you know, seeing that, discovering, like, learning about that moment in British TV and watching all of Black Audio Film Collective was an amazing breakthrough for me. You know, I had hints here and there. You know, when I was a teenager, I discovered My Beautiful Laundrette and Hun of Qureshi and thought, you know, oh, I can't believe this exists. But all of a sudden, I was seeing this work that you and your generation laid down at a time when it was harder, when, like you said, Jean-Marie, there weren't really models and there weren't other people doing it. And at the same time, this contemporary explosion of film by global majority filmmakers, both in the West and not. And so, yeah, I just wanted to kind of celebrate that. And I, you know, for better or worse, film festivals were what I knew. I had more money than ever before because of these unemployment payments from the pandemic. And I wanted it to be as accessible as possible. So I kind of created this free website where people could come for 10 days and watch stuff. And the title, the name you asked about, Prismatic Ground, I worked in a used bookstore in Detroit, a four-story used bookstore called King Books. And one day while I was there, I found this volume of poetry called, I think from 1937, called Prismatic Ground by the writer Marguerite Young, who's kind of an extraordinary cult author who should be much better known. But yeah, it was a timing thing. And then now, you know, you talked about the how maintaining one's artistic integrity, right, while trying to exist in this field. And I think it's harder than it's ever been, you know, because of Palestine and this kind of, you know, I'm looking for work right now and this kind of understanding that if you want lucrative jobs, if you want a career, like, keep your mouth shut. And what's amazing is that, like, you know, this, we have this work to lean on. I get so much sucker from this huge body of work that exists and people who have been talking about these issues for forever, you know. But it's so amazing that the June Jordan clip from Place of Rage went kind of viral for talking about, you know, I have a litmus test for whether someone is a good person. Do they support queer rights and do they support Palestine?
Yeah.
And so I just, at a time when it's incredibly difficult to contemplate just existing and making a living while holding on to one's values, I take so much like inspiration from, you know, the work that you all have created. And you know, and I think that's why I was so invested in it to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's really interesting. And this was one of my later questions actually for you, Ine, because, you know, you have Prismatic Ground, you have taken a very clear and strong stance against the genocide that's happening and in support of BDS, the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, supporting Palestine. And, you know, with the funding, have you received, you know, I mean, has that affected your ability to fundraise for your festival?
You know, I was in the position where partly I was able to do that because I didn't have much funding to begin with. You know, I had this 2-year grant from the Ford Foundation and they had never, you know, I had never done anything because they asked me to, or they had never criticized me. And I didn't ask them if I could, you know, commit to PAC B, this cultural boycott. And so, yeah, I think like just being small and lean and not really wanting to be this major institution again, which is a neoliberal impulse, is part of what's helped me. Again, you know, I know I can do this in a really small way, even if it means I have a few thousand dollars on a credit card right now. You know, it just, I know that I'm not reliant on these like $100,000 grants from institutions that would pull or not be likely to provide funding if I commit to the boycott.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's so, I mean, I'm like, you know, it's great that you're doing what you're doing, Ine, and I think that is hopeful because it's exactly the kind of spaces that independent, experimental, political filmmakers need, because we make work because we want it to be seen. We want it to be discussed. We want to have conversations with people about our work. We also want the work to actually sort of begin to question so many things that are taken for granted, or kind of, you know, question, but or give information that's often denied to people. And I think that, you know, it's because it's so damn difficult to make work and get funding for work that is in its content, not just in its content, but it's also in its formal approach that challenges so many kind of dominant expectations, that in the end, you know, you kind of have to, and I feel like I'm doing that now at the moment, going back to my kind of sari red days of sort of just making work without kind of spending weeks on end writing grant applications and fundraising letters, all of that. And there's a freedom in that. I think that there's a freedom in being able to not feel the... it's a double-edged thing, because on the one hand, I also feel like, why shouldn't we get the support that we deserve to make the work that we want to make? You know, we should be getting that support, particularly from organizations. And I sort of saw this and experienced this in the US, that funding organizations that kind of have these very kind of, you know, supposedly on the surface radical kind of mission statements about what kind of films they want to screen at their festivals, what kind of films they want to support. But when it comes down to it, when you look at what they in the end support or they screen, it's actually nothing that is, or very rarely is it work that is in any way challenging. There's a quote, you know, Toni Morrison quote, where she said, all good art is political. And the ones who try hard not to be political are agreeing to the status quo. And I think about that when you're writing your grant applications, you're like diffusing your politics and trying to get away with sort of not being too overtly political. And then think, but actually, in the end, that's not what I want to make. I have to be completely honest here about what is the work that I want to make and why I want to make it. It's been extremely difficult for me to get, like, the film I made on Alice Walker, Beauty and Truth, took 7 years. The very last film that I made about violence against women through the writings of Andrea Dworkin took another 7 years. So my next film's going to be, you know, a DIY down punk, going back to my punk days of making my own work.
I like to hear. You know, say the great irony of these grants and having to diffuse your politics is that they're, at the same time, they're asking you to perform your identity in a certain way that they can use to show their funders that they are, you know, promoting social justice in some concrete way.
I would like to jump in and maybe say something about about the forces in presence, I would say. The Francophone Africa, for instance, is in a place where you had the French who were subsidizing filmmaking, actually, in the Francophone regions of Africa. And at the same time, you had people who wanted to make film. And when I started, there were no labs locally. So most of the film had to be processed in France. And so the funding was to allow people to take the stock and then go and continue the work in Europe and in France. And the kind of funding that we could get, and we were fortunate because when Channel 4 was happening in Britain, we had also Arte in France and Germany being created. And that they were the people who were broadcasting the films that and we were having an avenue for African films and for African filmmakers. So I could get some funding through Arte France, because Arte had this very weird kind of structure, France and Germany. So whenever you will address questions that the French felt uncomfortable with, especially the colonial issues, they won't fund. And you had to go through Germany to be able to fund your films. And in the 90s, I had three films funded by Arte, but through Germany. And that was the very awkward situation. That allowed me to be able to make some films with some good funding at that time. And because I was going through Germany, I had a total control, because there was in Arte, program called Das Kleines Fensterspiel, called The Little Window. And that was curated by someone who was Eckhart Stein, who was really a celebrity in terms of really seeing, okay, we can work with you. You just come with your idea and you do exactly whatever you want to do. We don't want even to see the rough cut or your film at any stage. We just want you to bring the finished product. And that was really great to be able to make films with people who gave you the funding and who left you with the total control on whatever you wanted to say. That's how I was able to do Clando, A Trip to the Country, and even The Colonial Misunderstanding at one point. All these films were curated in a way, but at the same time said, okay, you just go as far as you want and And that allowed me to be able to challenge without anybody saying, well, people don't really understand. And that was, we had the total freedom to make the films at that, in that particular context.
When did you feel that kind of support declined or disappeared? And as a result of what?
Oh, but actually it was because Das kleine Fernsehspiel, that program at one point, they got fed up. And I think Eckerstein went to retirement and now he has passed away. But he was a figure that was really instrumental into having this program, this window, this small window. But when Eckerstein left, they took that as an opportunity to get rid of this program. Yeah. And you had, I think it was in the middle of the years or the end of the first decade of the 2000 that this stopped.
You know, I'd like to, Jean-Marie, just, you know, talk to you a bit about form since you brought it up. Yeah. So in rewatching your films, I'm really struck by how radical they still are. Not only in your essay style and critique, your voiceover critique, but just the way all of them, just how your films are constructed. So, you know, what struck me this time recently watching, I think it's really apparent that you're not addressing a white audience. You're also not explaining things or trying to lull your audience into kind of eating up what you have to say. It's more like you're provoking your audience. Your films are a provocation, I think, in that you're trying to evoke a kind of spectatorial resistance. So in a way, you're asking audiences to awaken to these issues and to interrogate not only the issues, but also themselves. What is my, as a viewer, what is my relationship to what's being shown? And so I'd just like you to unpack that a bit, if you can, you know.
Yes, it's...
If it's something you intended or...
Yes, of course, I cannot say... I wanted to say things at the same time. As I said, the basic questions are always how and why? And suddenly I'm facing things that I have to say. And I just said to myself, this is so hard. Let's put some spice in it so that people are not totally frustrated, totally upset. Bring some humor. And gradually I have to think of the audience, but not necessarily the European audience, because as I was living in Europe, showing my work in Europe and having the kind of reactions that really pissed me off really seriously, because when I showed my first short film, many people came to me and said, but no, nobody in Africa will understand your films. They are too intellectual for people. I just say, what? If you can understand, what makes you think that people in Africa won't understand? So by seeing the level of, I would not be offensive by saying the level of the public, not stupidity, because it's too, the level of people not knowing or not understanding, not knowing so much. And I was just asking myself, why am I spending so much time trying to educate people who I don't even care, actually, because I go to many cinemas showing my first film here in France and be faced with so much ignorance on so many levels that I was just there trying to educate people in their own history. And at one point I was just saying, well, what is the point? So I just decided to focus on probably trying to educate and to talk to the people in my own community who needed to learn these elements that they don't see, they don't have in textbooks, that they don't have in public discourse, in public, and try to bring all this with some humor and with very nicely and very gently, and also invite them to go and try to get more, to learn more about what happened. Because as the whole, almost the whole history of our countries, and especially in Cameroon, were written by people from outside in a perspective that was not the local perspective. I gave myself the mission or the goal to talk from a local perspective and tell, bring some repair that will be the local one, so that people can look at the world from a perspective that is close to them. And by doing that, I needed to also find the kind of formal way of telling stories, and the narrations that I use are very close to the kind of storytelling when people tell stories, because I was always struck when I had many people around me and we'd have the same event, the way everyone is going to tell the same, that event just fascinated me. And I was always there saying, wow, this is what happened. And one person would start it in a different place to come to the same story. Another person would come to. And so for me, that was really very inspirational in terms of how do I make my films, trying to find the right angle to tell that story that will mirror the way people, and also the multiplicity of sometimes people seeing the same thing and the multiplicity of angles they are seeing them, and try to make it coherent being told by the same one person. So that's why my films are full of different digressions, going this way, coming that way, and then coming together and having many different people talking, so that at the end, maybe it gives the kind of global vision of a situation. So, and in my country, people do that so often. So I just decide to try to use it the way when I'm trying to make films. And people really follow it. And sometimes people say, if you are trying to theorize that, what will you put it into? And I just say, I really don't know. But maybe some scholar will do that at one point. But that's the way people tell stories. So
yeah, well, it just seems that you really have a connection to the collective. I think that really comes through, obviously, in your films. And that, again, is oppositional to the idea that, you know, with a lot of character-driven documentaries where you know, somebody might be from the community, but you elevate this one person who becomes this hero and you follow their journey and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, then it becomes about product in the end, whereas you interview a lot of people and they tell you about their relationship to the community. So it's more about process rather than product. And so, Pratibha, I just wondered if you'd want to chime in.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what Jean-Marie is talking about is like taking your starting point, Jean-Marie, being you're not the white gaze or not wanting to be in a position to having to explain what you're doing, but actually just continuing to do it from your point of view. And I think it's very much about the point of view and what point of view you begin with. And I was just reminded when you were talking about some of the responses you had initially to some of your work, you know, one of the responses I had to Sari Red when it was screened at the Flaherty seminar, you know, the Flaherty seminar, like, you know, you bow down to the Flaherty seminar that you get even invited. And in fact, John Acumfra and I had got invited to it. And, you know, and I'd only made two videos at that point. I'd only made Emergence and Sari Red, and they showed Sari Red. Once it was screened, and then, you know, there was this very tall white guy who stood up and who said, well, I really didn't understand that, because it's like you have to explain. It's a very closed, the signs and symbols you're using are very closed. And, you know, you need to translate them. I have no access into this video. And I just said, well, you know, we have been doing the work of translation of the dominant imagery and dominant symbols and dominant language of cinema. So I think it's about time you maybe learn how to translate our very culturally specific you know, modes of storytelling. And of course, I had no idea who this guy was. And apparently he turned out to be some kind of big shot professor of film or something. And there was a huge, big, like, explosion and a, you know, a real kind of heated discussion. Yeah. I mean, I was only just starting out. And then it was all reported in the Village Voice that then Pratibha Palmer said this and da-da-da. And I'm like, you know, why should it be so challenging when we make work from our own point of view, when we make work from our own grounded kind of, as you said, the global majority point of view, and do not pander to having to simplify our work or Absolutely. To make, you know, and to make the work soothing for their kind of maybe, you know, try and not disturb their kind of comfort zones too much. You know, and I'm not interested in telling those kind of stories. I never have been. You know, I want to tell stories that kind of create these sort of fissures of change, or, you know, that crack opens dominant narratives, so that kind of say, here are some people here who have their stories to tell and you've never heard them. So it's like Toni Morrison again, she would say, you know, she wrote the stories and she stood where she stood and the center had to come to her, making her the center. And I think that that's kind of, you know, the sort of premise of a lot of work that so many of us do, is that, you know, we are not going to compromise so that the center feels comfortable, so that the center understands what we are trying to say. And, you know, our stories from the so-called periphery are actually usually the majority stories.
That's so well yeah. said, Pratibha. That's great.
Yeah, very much so.
So in a, you know, you obviously see a lot of current, you know, experimental oppositional work. Some of it might be experimental in form only. And that, you know, that's great. But as you said, you are looking for, you know, kind of a political viewpoint as well. I'm just curious, you know, is there a lot of this work available now? I mean, are a lot of makers making kind of, you know, work that you would, you know, that you could term oppositional? Is that a quaint term, or is it like useful, or is it relevant? I'm just wondering how you sort of, you know, from what you see that's out there now, how you kind of put it all together.
Yeah, I'm not one to quabble over terms, oppositional, subversive, experiment, you know, avant-garde. But I, you know, to Pratibha's points, there's a lot of racial hierarchy around the notion of form, right? On the one hand, narrative is used to reinforce racial hierarchy, but there's also a lot of it around what we call experimental and avant-garde work. You know, you talk about, you know, the exalted status of certain institutions. And that goes for certain filmmakers too. You know, there's this like primacy given to the work of people like Jonas Mekas and, you know, Nathaniel Dorsky or Stan Brakhage. And I love these filmmakers, but you can still feel that kind of like legitimacy lended a certain lineage of avant-garde work. And it would be, I think it's just blind not to admit that there's a racial element to that, again, because it's legible in a certain way to white audience, to a certain sector of white audiences in the West. And I do think that there are a lot of more global majority filmmakers now making work. And I do think it has become more accessible. You know, during the festival, I try to make a certain amount of films available freely online everywhere still. There's a collection on Criterion Channel of shorts that have played at Prismatic Ground. And they have started a little bit to show more experimental work. And, you know, I think that's how a lot of people saw A Place of Rage in recent months. But so it's becoming more available, but it's still a little bit of a, you know, my metric is always, would How would me as a kid in suburban Michigan have struck upon this work? And it's still a journey to get to it, I think, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it can be more rewarding when you've, but like for these ideas to have greater penetration, and again, like to buck the kind of racist elitism you were talking about, Jean-Marie, that like who is this work for and who will understand it? That's a huge part of the work, I think, is to say this work is for anybody, right? It just requires a little curiosity, and people can accept it on their own terms. There's not a certain way to watch it, or a certain group of people whom it's exclusive to. And so, yeah, I think the more widely it becomes available, the more people will realize that there's something in this work for them.
And do you think that the, you know, you mentioned you've got a program on Criterion. Do you think that these sort of larger media distribution companies are more open to this work now? Do you feel there's kind of a democratization there or not really, you know?
I would not use the word democratization because we know technology is not neutral, just like films and institutions are not neutral. You know, obviously, it's still a problem that Criterion is the, capital C criteria, you know, that there aren't more venues for people to appreciate and discover a certain kind of work. But, it's like, can we at least push these institutions to do better by us? And sometimes they do step up and do so. And, you know, I think not to like lavish too much praise or whatever, but I think Criterion has made an effort in recent years to understand the work that they've neglected and the harm that's been caused by that neglect and to correct it a little bit. And I think, yeah, people making their work available online, there's a lot of work you just see, but again, it's really hard for people to just discover work that way. They need some kind of envoy, whether it's a distributor or an individual who's enthusiastic about the work, to say, come see this, it's for you. So I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't say there's been a democratization, but there has been greater availability. And I hope that trend continues.
I mean, Jean-Marie, I know, you know, you have started this school. And so a filmmaking school in Cameroon, in Banjoun, in your home area. I wanted to talk to all of you about how, you know, given the realities of the landscape now, how you keep going and what keeps you motivated, and again, how you keep your integrity. So Jean-Marie, I was wondering if you could just talk a bit, you know, about your school and about what you hope, you know, how you kind of further your ideas in this way.
Yes, I will go from this notion of experimental filmmaking. It was always almost, for me, when I started making film, of course, I met John Acomfrat, Black Audio Collective. They were really brilliant. That was in Britain. But from the African continent, it was difficult for people who were entering the business of filmmaking not to follow the footsteps of what existed already, because people will say, oh, you should go to a film school and learn how to make this right and everything. So they always wanted people who were still learning from the African continent and from the people who didn't have the authority. Whenever things will come from them, they will not be granted the possibility of being artists. They will always say, oh, that's wrong, because that's not the way it should be done. So the whole colonial process is also to really make people fit into avenues, fit into formal elements. And this way of training, the whole colonial education is also that, to make people obedient, to show them what to do. And in the African continent, we have always been subjected to that. And most of the people who were coming to to teach were coming from Europe, and there were a lot of funding put there for them to come and really, I will say, format people into knowing what is good, even telling them what is good and what is not good. So I was really so tired of having young people showing some film, and a young man will come to me or a young woman and say, oh, but in your film, there were some cuts that were not really good cuts. And I just said, oh, how do you define what is the good cut? What is, and then you say, we were taught this and this. I say, oh, so having multiple occasions, young people learning to make film and rethinking that it was like the biblical thing. I just said to them, let's go and go back into the history of cinema. Who decided these rules? Who created the, who told everybody the way to make film? So you want to tell a story, you want to say something, use the tool, and really, if you want to throw your camera up and while it's filming, do it. Who is, no one is. And so, because I was so tired of this institutionalized education coming from Europe to say, to tell people how to make films and also how to think, because suddenly by doing that, they also say what is good or what is not good. And I just felt like we really need to have a place where people can come with an idea, and we will push the idea as far as possible to the point where people can just become creative and go as far as possible. And like the my school or the place is just to accompany them, to push them as far as possible with all the tools available into filmmaking, and even invent and bring some elements of the storytelling locally so that all this can fit into filmmaking. And one of the first things I tell them is that, well, no one has explored the way we tell stories. You are going to make films. Use everything around you to tell your film, to tell your stories. And the idea of my school is to deconstruct all these colonial constraints that we put into filmmaking and into people, where they say, oh, you need to make feel-good kind of fiction. You need to not talk about things that are, make people uncomfortable. So I just said, no, you talk about whatever you want. And I created my first, the workshop, Heritage. The Heritage workshop is to really talk about what is around us, because I was tired of people trying to create stories that were so circumvoluted, and just say, look around you, there are so much, we have the whole continent to build, you have so much to do, and the pioneers of cinema thought that cinema could contribute into really changing also this continent. Why do Europe, who were funding cinema, fought us so much to really turn the cinema into mirroring the kind of the way they saw cinema in Europe, and not really let us turn cinema into something that can be of importance to the continent and to the place we are in our history. So that's why my school, to continue this fight, to really continue to deconstruct all this colonial discourse that is so present into people's mind.
Yeah, I think it's so you know, vital. I mean, I've been, you know, I think, you know, the scene, say, in East Africa, which I know a bit better, is so different, because, I mean, there hasn't been a long filmmaking tradition, you know, from East Africa. And so there are a lot, and, you know, and this is amazing that there is a whole documentary community that is growing there, and that are really making, you know, strides very quickly, and have done some great work on the world stage. But I do feel that the, you know, all the workshops, like if it's from the US or Europe, they're mostly, you know, the money comes from the US and Europe, right? And so there is, in the workshops and in the methodology of teaching, there is this sameness, you know, again, there's this, it is exactly what you said, it's a mirroring of the Western types of filmmaking and Western tropes. And so I just feel like it's so vital to have a school and a place to learn the criticality, so that you can make films that oppose this sort of mirroring. And I mean, Fatiba, you've really gone through different forms, making, you know, experimental work to traditional documentary, and then going back again to a kind of hybrid form with My Name is Andrea. And I just have a question for you. I wonder, I mean, I know for me, having just finished a documentary that is character driven, I think we thought, okay, we want to make it accessible to a really wide amount of people. And so we went for the character driven thing. But in the end, I feel like in a way, even though it's critiquing colonialism, it is kind of reproducing it as well. I think it was Audre Lorde who said, you know, you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools. I'm wondering if you found that in the more traditional documentaries you did.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would say that I've never made a character-driven documentary. And and I don't think that any of my documentaries actually fall into traditional documentary, you know, that trope. I think that I have used talking heads, definitely. You know, Place of Rage is full of talking heads. But for me, it's always about who's doing the talking. And here you have Angela Davis, June Jordan, Alice Walker doing the talking. You've got Fannie Lou Hamer. You've got these African-American women who shaped and created a particular kind of history, and they're doing the talking. And I had a very, you know, it was very intentional to create that space in a film that I knew was going to be on primetime television, that these women had the space to speak about and narrate their own histories and their own stories. And so, you know, I think that in similarly, the documentary I made about Alice Walker and, you know, the sort of the biography, as it were, a portrait of Alice Walker, Kush, which was about South Asian LGBTQ people. I mean, you know, that had like these dramatic vignettes, and then that had archival black and white footage of old Bollywood films. And it was a kind of a pastiche and of the montage of the storytelling. So in a sense, I feel like even when I have worked within the traditional platform of a television, and where it, you know, where I've had the funding from, I've tried in whatever way that I possibly could to stretch the limits of that kind of traditional documentary form, and to actually bring in different ways of kind of evoking textures and evoking color and sound. The way the sound reflects something completely different to what is expected. So, you know, I've tried intentionally to disrupt the traditional documentary space with a kind of what I would say is my kind of diasporic sensibility, because it sort of is a diasporic. It isn't located in any one place. It comes from a lot of different kinds of locations and displacements too. You know?
Yeah, great. Well, I guess that might be a great place to wrap it up. You know, I mean, if you have any sort of thoughts about the future or where you'd like things to be, I'd love you to share those.
I mean, I think I should say too that, like, while I also agree that, like, form is important politically, I don't think we're going to decolonize the world through film. You know, it's a bit like film is one thing, and then collective action is another, and we need to be doing both, right? As artists, there's the art, and then as human beings, there's the, you know, connecting with our community and taking actions as we see fit. But I think that artistically, my hope right now is in what Fatiba talked about earlier, like just going back, making films on a small scale with no money, and just not being beholden to anyone. You know, I think that, like, that to me, that's where the most exciting work is being made right now, by people with very few resources who are using that as a strength. And, you know, yeah, I guess I would just like to encourage more artists to follow that path and see what can come of it, because basically every institution we rely on has failed us in this moment, I think.
I mean, I would just, very quick little response to that would be that I agree, but I also think that we have to also think about sustainability. And how do we sustain ourselves when we, you know, are not getting the kind of support that we should be getting in making the work that we want to make on our own terms? But I think that's a whole kind of other discussion too. Yeah, I mean, thank you. It's been a great conversation. Really interesting to hear from all of you. So thanks, Mina, for bringing us all together.
Thank you. Yeah. And I just want to say one small thing. There have been so many films made. And what is really amazing is that the younger generation doesn't have access to all these films that existed. And I'm appalled to see whenever I show some of the old films, the films of the 60s, the 70s, they're just there saying, oh, at that time people were thinking and doing things like that. It seems to just discover that people have been thinking and using cinema in a very thoughtful way. And that cinema is not like they see in TikTok and all these social media where they have small bits of 10 seconds, 15 seconds. And that cinema is also a process of thinking, reflecting, and doing things. And I really would like to be able to share so many films from all over the place, Indian films, Chinese film, Japanese film, South American, the first cinema, to the young filmmakers today, for them to see that cinema has been evolving and people have been using cinema for different and many ways to challenge society.
That's wonderful. Thank you so, so much to all of you. Yeah, it's been really great. And thank you again.
Thank you.